Hello, this is Al Reynolds from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall share with you the Triangle Business Journal, dated April 26th. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This week's top article, top of the fold, Citrix, Innovative Salesforce in Bolivia, by Lauren K. Onisorge. This article is from Raleigh. How would you like to be paid in sunshine dollars? That's an inside joke at a Bolivian startup with Duke University roots, SalesSource. It's a startup that, instead of paying employees hefty salaries, pays them primarily with paradise living, a Bolivian homestead, or, starting in July, a beachfront office in Costa Rica. The company aims to contract with larger firms looking for more cost-effective labor, and it has already found a client in Citrix Systems. Citrix contracts with SalesSource to utilize its cheap American-born talent in South America. So far, the team has 10 on board in Bolivia who work from a call center. It's expensive to have people in the U.S., notes SalesSource CEO and Duke student Tito Burt. But in South America, the company's $600 per month pay average is legal and doable. Throw in some sunshine, and it's worth it to the recent graduates SalesSource hires, he says. It's an idea that sprouted from Duke University, where Burt is currently finishing his bachelor's degree. Through entrepreneur contacts, he met ShareFile founder Jesse Lipson, a Duke grad who now works for Citrix, which bought ShareFile. Soon after the introduction, the pair flew to New York to work out specifics. He said, "My sales team is growing from 8 people to 200 over the next 2 years," Bort said of that initial conversation in December 2011. "I said, why aren't you outsourcing?" Lipson told Bort he would rather have American people serving American customers. "That made sense to me," Bort says, adding that from Lipson he learned that the sales staff didn't have person-to-person interaction. Sales activity happened from a call center, and perhaps, he thought, that call center could be located in his native Bolivia. After a few site visits by Citrix employees, the partnership became official. ShareFile here in Raleigh interviews people, and when they decide who they want to hire, it's actually my company that hires those people, Bort explains. The wage, however, minimal, is a livable one in South America, he says. Hired workers have six-month contracts, and if they're effective salespeople, they can either stay on in South America or interview for a position with Citrix in Raleigh. The company has hired several North Carolina college graduates, he adds, including some from East Carolina University and Appalachian State University. So far, one member of the SalesSource team has found permanent employment with Citrix, Lipson says. The 10-person team in Bolivia will number 15 in July. That's when they'll move into an undisclosed location in Costa Rica. Bort says he's looking for oceanfront. Even with capital costs, Bort says his company is profitable. Lipson says that the relationship is specific to Citrix. They are essentially outsourcing lead generation and sales resources, he says. Lipson says it's not just the finances that intrigue him, it's the concept, one he says that works well in down economy. It's interesting, especially with unemployment being so high for recent college grads, he says. Recent numbers released by the Economic Policy Institute put the unemployment rate for young, recent college graduates at 8.8%. Bort says he expects to have 40 employees participating in the program in 2014. Lipson says that's in line with his own expectations. "We're 260 employees right now, so probably by the end of 2014 we'll be well over double that, so I would imagine that if the program is working well for us, we'll probably grow our investment," he replies. More than 100 of those 260 employees are in sales. Larry Robbins, partner at Wywick Robbins in Raleigh, says the setup appears to be a traditional outsourcing play, but while sunshine is an attraction, he cautions that when you add in low wages, the program might not draw top quality talent. While Bullard won't release his finances, he says the company is already drawing in dollars, so much so that he is preparing a $10,000 donation to the school he says made it all possible, Duke University. Next up, labor agencies offering more aid to workers. This article is by Chris Bagley and is from Raleigh. While employees' own lawsuits have long been their main tool for recouping unpaid wages, increased federal oversight has also made an impact in the last 4 years, attorneys for both employees and employers say. Under President Barack Obama, the U.S. Labor Department has hired at least 150 additional investigators to respond to employees' complaints, including 7 or 8 in North Carolina. The department collected a record $225 million in back wages on behalf of employees in the 2010-11 fiscal year and $281 million in the 2011-12 year. The feeling among defense counsel in general is that sort of enforcement has picked up, says Sarah Ford, an attorney at Parker Poe who represents employers in investigations and litigations. Aggrieved employees go to the U.S. and North Carolina labor departments far more often than to federal and state courts, in part because of the cost of lawsuits and in part because the agencies keep complaints anonymous. Even so, the agencies assess penalties or reach settlements in only a fraction of the cases. The federal agency, particularly, concentrates most heavily on cases that involve multiple workers. In one instance, in mid-April, a Raleigh-based construction company agreed to pay 4 employees $20,000 in back wages following an investigation. The agency's wage and hour caseload has grown to nearly 1,000 a year as its staff of investigators has grown to 36, up from 28 in 2008, says Rick Braylock, top administrator for the U.S. Labor Department's Wage and Hour Division in North Carolina. The majority want to be in compliance, Blaylock says of employers. It's not their real intention to cheat their employees. The agency can levy fines or sue on behalf of workers. The North Carolina Department of Labor Department pursues similar investigations of employers with fewer than 30 employees and less than $500,000 in annual revenue. Valentine Ucare, the department's wage and hour administrator, says the number of complaints coming in the door hasn't changed significantly over the last few years, but the amount of back wages it assessed in the last 3 years was its highest on record. It also collected record amounts in the last 3 years, largely because employers now contest the assessments less often than they once did, he says. The employers are more willing to pay and get us out of their hair, he says. Additionally, Ucare says he's recently tasked his 18 investigators to be more aggressive in collecting back wages that employers have already consented to pay. When agreeing to catch up on wages through payment plans, an employer signs documents that the agency and workers can take to court if the employer falls behind on the payments. And now this week's lead article, is called Overworked and Underpaid, Wage and Hour Complaints Fill North Carolina Courts. This article was also written by Chris Bagley and is from Raleigh. Lisa Bullock had worked for the Independent Garage Owners of North Carolina for a little more than 2 years when she was suddenly terminated in May 2011. Now she's alleging that she worked 65-hour weeks while getting paid for only 40. The company misclassified her as being exempt from overtime pay and owes her potentially tens of thousands of dollars as a result, according to a lawsuit that she has filed. Bullock is not alone, and neither is IGO, a Raleigh-based nonprofit insurer for automotive mechanics. Across North Carolina and beyond, workers are complaining in growing numbers that they're not being paid for what they are owed, reflecting tight times for employees and employers alike. The evidence shows up in complaint statistics at both state and federal labor departments and in stacks of files on employment lawyers' desks. The volume of cases started increasing in the early days of the recession and, by some measures, has grown further even as the economy recovers. The workers include a food service employee at Rex Hospital in Raleigh, who says she did unpaid work before the official start of her shift. Then there's a Raleigh Limousine Company employee who says she was underpaid for on-call time. Those complaints are fairly typical. A large number of so-called wage and hour cases center on allegations that employers misclassified the employees for certain work they performed in order to avoid paying overtime. One of several common reasons for being exempt from overtime is that an employee is a supervisor. Wage and hour actions are hardly new, but they've grown more common in the last 5 years or so, according to attorneys and some, though not all, government statistics. The North Carolina Department of Labor, which investigates most wage and hour allegations against small employers, assessed an average of about $4 million a year in back wages in 2010, 11, and 12 fiscal years, according to the annual report that it released in March. In contrast, it assessed an average of about $1.7 million in the previous 5 years. The $2.2 million it collected for employees in 2012 was a record. Even so, plaintiff's attorneys say those numbers are tiny fractions of the totals and that most wage scofflaws are out of the reach of regulators. There's no single way of measuring all the complaints out there, partly because of the patchwork of state and federal agencies that investigate employees' allegations and the state and federal courts where employees sue. Attorneys ascribed some of the growth of wage cases to intensified efforts by employers to contain costs. In even more cases, they say, employees' own financial hardships have prompted them and their attorneys to more closely scrutinize pay practices that have existed for years. Randy Avram, a Kilpatrick Townsend partner who defends employers in North Carolina and several other states, says his wage and hour caseload has doubled in the past 5 years. Many companies don't understand wage and hour laws, Avram says. Plaintiffs are uncovering pay practices that are incorrect or appear to be incorrect. Because employees almost never sue their current employer, most wage and hour cases are triggered by an employee's firing or resignation. Bullock's attorney, Joy Ryan Webb, says she doubts that underpayment is significantly more common than it was a decade ago. The waves of termination since 2007 have probably been the bigger factor, she says. Several attorneys say they've noticed the U.S. Labor Department growing more aggressive in its enforcement of wage standards under President Barack Obama. Webb says she believes that has alerted plaintiffs' attorneys to more potential issues. I've become a lot more aware of what I need to be looking for, she says. As for Bullock's case, IGO says in response to her lawsuit that it believes it accurately classified Bullock as exempt from overtime pay and that in any case she didn't work any overtime hours. The case was initially filed in state court in September 2012 but has been transferred to federal court, which is usually seen as being a better venue for employers. Court-ordered mediation is expected to begin next week. IGO's attorney, Ted Kazoglis of Jackson Lewis and Carey, says he's seen allegations of misclassification becoming more common in the last few years. Like others interviewed, he sees a correlation with the recession. Not all wage and hour lawsuits center on allegations of misclassification, though, and many of the other reasons are similarly correlated with the economy. Employees sometimes allege that they simply haven't been paid or that they're consistently paid weeks late. In still other cases, companies categorize workers as independent contractors rather than W-2 employees. Making that choice involves numerous questions about where and how an employee works. As a result, honest mistakes are common. Avram and others say wage violations are easier for workers to prove than are many other types of allegations against employers, particularly when companies fail to keep good records. They're more lucrative, too. Some involve liquidated damages, doubling an employer's total payout, and many involve attorney fees. As a result, many attorneys for employers encourage their clients to rectify a mistake as soon as they discover it, rather than waiting for a lawsuit or an investigation by a state or federal agency. The following is a sidebar to the previous article. It's entitled, Employers Often Fail to Understand Intricacies of Wage and Hour Laws. This sidebar is also written by Chris Bagley. Employer-side lawyers and a surprising number of plaintiff-side lawyers say honest mistakes lead dozens of employers, particularly small companies without specialized HR staff, to underpay their workers. Here are several common mistakes that they cite. 1. Giving employees comp time. An employee who works 50 hours for 1 week might be required to work only 30 hours the next week. That's particularly common when the 2 weeks are in the same pay period. But private sector employers still have to pay 50% more for the 10 hours of overtime in the first week, says Ted Gazalgas, a Jackson Lewis partner in Cary. 2. Not paying overtime pay to an employee whose pay is expressed as an annual salary rather than an hourly wage. Depending on numerous specifics of an employee's job, he or she may be due extra pay for working more than 40 hours a week, says Randy Avram, an employment lawyer and partner at Kilpatrick Townsend in Raleigh. 3. In fact, misclassification is common for a whole slew of reasons. In short, there's no simple mathematical formula for determining how an employee should be classified. For that reason, attorneys say a small turn in litigation can push one side or the other toward a settlement. 4. What starts as an honest mistake sometimes continues even after the employer realizes that employees are being underpaid. But many employers actually call in to report themselves, thereby saving untold sums in legal costs, says Rick Blaylock, director of the Raleigh Office for the U.S. Department of Labor. You're really treated differently if the employee was maybe owed a little bit of money versus an intentional attempt to underpay, says Sarah Ford, and she's a litigator with Parker Poe in Raleigh. Continuing inside the front cover, BioLix, assets in hand, Synthon stays put here. This article is by Lauren K. Onisorge and is from the Research Triangle Park. Armed with assets from the defunct BioLex Therapeutics, the Dutch firm Synthon is ready to give Research Triangle Park another shot. But will it fare any better than BioLex? Company officials say that Synthon would close its 35-employee RTP facility last year. Instead, Synthon has been pulled back in by an asset deal it made almost exactly a year ago with Pittsburgh-based BioLex. The acquisition involved BioLex's patented Lex system, a biologics manufacturing platform that uses a type of duckweed culture to grow pharmaceutical proteins. It also involved people such as BioLex scientist Lynn Dickey, who's now Synthon's local site lead. Synthon CEO Randy Mareel said at the time that the manufacturing technology would help Synthon develop and commercialize additional products. It will boost our own innovative work in our strategic therapeutic areas, bringing it to fruition in the second half of this decade, and enhance opportunities for strategic partnerships, he said. It also boosted interest in North Carolina, forcing Synthon to give North Carolina, and RTP specifically, a second look. The intent is to close down the facilities on August 31st, Synthon's then-general manager Wayne Brinster said in February 2012. At the time, local operations included analytical labs and a packaging plant at RTP. Activities consisted of registration, packaging, and sales activity for Synthon's North American operations. He said then that the move was about meeting market demands, but that changed with new assets. Dickey confirms that while the packaging operation was relocated, the site is thriving in 2013 due to BioLex's technology. In the period after the acquisition, we evaluated the two locations and initiated the move of the platform from the Pittsburgh site to RTP by redesigning our RTP facility, spokeswoman Fabienne Duven writes in an email. The new research and development labs opened at the end of 2012. A new Good Manufacturing Practice GMP facility is moving ahead at full speed, Duven writes. The GMP facility will produce duckweed-based proteins necessary for the development platform and should be complete in 2013, meaning that much of what used to be BioLex in Pittsburgh will move to Synthon's RTP campus this year. We will initiate production of the first GMP clinical batches of our own first product in the system at RTP in 2014, Duvin says. The new activities at RTP solely revolve around the research and development within Synthon's biopharmaceutical division. In these difficult economic times, we are establishing a new biotechnology business at RTP, Duvin adds. Instead of the 35 that the site employed previously, however, only 17 full-time employees remain, including those relocating from the BioLex site. That relocation is scheduled to be complete by the end of 2013. But will they fare any better with duckweed than BioLex? That company, helmed by CEO Jan Turek and backed by investors such as Durham's InterSouth Partners, filed for Chapter 7 liquidation last year, despite having been a $190 million business at its peak. Moving on to the commercial and real estate section by Amanda Jones Hoyle. This article is entitled, Secrets of the Umstead Revealed. So you've heard of the Umstead Hotel, but have you heard of the Umstead Cafe? It's among the secrets that the management team of the Cary Hotel site for attaining accolades, such as being the only hotel restaurant property in North Carolina to achieve both a 5-star rating from Forbes Travel Guide and a 5-diamond rating from AAA. In a chat over lunch at Umstead's Herons Restaurant, General Manager Jim Bealey, Director of Marketing Lee Goodnight, and Marketing Manager Dara White offer the inside story on that secret and others. 1. The Umstead Cafe. The Umstead employs more than 300 people and has more than 150 associates on site every day of the week. So the hotel created a separate restaurant for the staff called the Umstead Cafe on the ground floor of the property. It serves lunch and dinner free to all Umstead employees, and even has its own cook, Brandon Edwards, who prepares hot buffet items and a full salad bar with organic produce sourced from the Umstead's own farm. 2. Culinary Farm. About 4 years ago, Lee Goodnight and Heron's chef Scott Crawford came up with the idea to begin growing their own organic produce for the restaurant and for the Umstead, and Goodnight was able to secure a 1-acre plot of land on the nearby SAS campus to get it started. They even hired a farmer, Maggie Lawrence, to work the garden full-time and coordinate weekly produce needs with the hotel's chefs and cooks. 3. Locally Sourced. For the items that the SAS farm can't provide, the Umstead and Herons has partnered with more than a dozen farms across North Carolina, Virginia, and Georgia for meats, cheeses, and other specialty products. The Umstead also switched to using Larry's Beans, a Raleigh-based coffee roaster, for all of its coffee products in November. The hotel's gift shop even features items made by local artists, including handbags by Holly Aiken, wooden bowls by Jason Van Duen, jewelry by Jessica Thomas, and Casual Delights cookies by Indra Hoover. 4. Custom Tailored. The Umstead employs a full-time seamstress with a background in theater and costume design who custom fits associates' uniforms by tailoring them to fit properly. And 5. Umstead University. The hotel in 2012 launched an initiative to encourage and provide learning opportunities to all associates, including tuition reimbursement, eCornell courses, as well as a study hall, a monthly manager-led industry-specific course that is free and open to all associates. Quite a hotel. Next up, Eastman pledges $10 million in research. NC State University and chemical firm form partnership that could become a model. This article is by Jason DeBrune and is under the column headed Healthcare, Nonprofits, and Sports and Business. NC State University and Eastman Chemical Company have formed a partnership unlike nearly any in the nation, one that guarantees the university that Eastman will spend $10 million on research at its Centennial Campus Center. It is also one the university hopes to use as a model for private partners in the future and could become a model for other universities as public research funding declines. The Raleigh University and the Chemical Company, headquartered in Kingsport, Tennessee, ceremonially kicked off the partnership at the Eastman Innovation Center on NCSU's Centennial Campus on April 18. What's unusual about the relationship is the way the two sides negotiated intellectual property rights to potential groundbreaking research findings at that building. Historically, private companies provide a research contract to a university, and if researchers at the university make a groundbreaking discovery, the university and company then start negotiating how much of the intellectual property belongs to the university and researchers, the brains, and how much should stay with the company, the money behind the project. In the Eastman-NCSU relationship, both sides negotiated boilerplate agreements ahead of time. If researchers make a discovery that Eastman considers strategic, meaning likely to produce revenue, it would keep a larger share of the IP. If it considers the findings important but not strategic, the IP is shared. If findings are not important, then NCSU keeps the IP, explains Gary Luce, technology liaison for the Eastman Innovation Center. Contract specifics weren't released, but Chancellor Randy Woodson says the university didn't negotiate much of a different agreement than it would have had on the back end. It just got there much sooner. Furthermore, he says owning intellectual property should not be a university's goal. Instead, it should create value. We don't want to hang up the research because of the negotiations, he says. Eastman CEO James Rogers agrees, saying the leadership at NCSU had a real-world understanding about how intellectual property works, and that it started negotiating much closer to the middle, which ultimately helped Eastman choose NCSU over dozens of other potential university partners. In return, the university received the guarantee of $10 million in research contracts from Eastman, meaning a pledge of that much in research spending from the company. As it becomes harder to fight for research contracts, having that $10 million guarantee grows all the more valuable to a university, with establishing a long-term relationship that can turn into $15 million, $20 million or more. Once you have that relationship, the ability to multiply it is much easier. Also on the same column, Pell Grant, costs rise as students seek aid. This article was also written by Jason DeBrun. Increasing college tuition costs, coupled with federal budget hawks looking to reduce spending, have brought increased scrutiny of how the federal government subsidizes student loans. To that end, the Simpson-Bowles Commission suggests a minor tweak of what it says would save taxpayers $55 billion. It would eliminate the in-school interest subsidy, which allows undergraduate students to defer the accrual of interest on student loans until after they graduate. The subsidy is neither well-targeted to those who need it nor effective in encouraging higher education, according to an April report from the Commission. Savings could be used to strengthen the Pell Grant program, which provides need-based aid and does more to benefit students who need financial aid. President Barack Obama, in his proposed budget, asked Congress to increase the maximum grant by $140 to $5,785. The Simpson-Bowles Commission supports the request, but points out that the program is facing a $50 million funding gap through 2023. For the 2007-08 school year, the entire program disbursed $14.7 trillion in grants. By the end of the 2010-11 school year, that rose to $35.7 trillion. Here's a breakdown of area universities that have students receiving Pell Grants in the Triangle. At NC State University, 6,133 recipients received $25.8 million. At North Carolina Central University, 4,333 recipients received $21.8 million. UNC at Chapel Hill, 3,855 recipients received $17.1 million. At Duke University, 929 recipients received $4.1 million. And at Wake Tech, 7,396 recipients received $24.4 million. And Durham Tech, 3,318 recipients received $10.7 million. At Shaw University, 2,141 recipients received $9.8 million. St. Augustine's University, 1,272 recipients received $6.1 million. Meredith College had 673 recipients receiving $2.8 million. And William Peace University, with 410 recipients, received $1.8 million of Pell Grants. This week's column that covers infotech, biotechnology, and entrepreneurism is by Lauren K. Onisorge. And her first article is IBM's server unit is in sight of Lenovo. As the number of PCs sold continues to dwindle, Lenovo could be searching for acquisitions to grow in other areas. After all, it's done that before. In 2005, the Chinese computer manufacturer acquired IBM's PC business, propelling it to a global market, along with the establishment of a U.S. headquarters in Morrisville. Now, with the PC market on a downswing, could it be looking at IBM again, this time for its 86X server business? IDC reports that PC shipments posted the steepest single-quarter decline ever in the first quarter, with worldwide shipments totaling 76.3 million units, down by 13.9% from the same quarter last year. While Lenovo executives would not comment on reports that the company might be supplementing its already robust server division by purchasing Big Blue's, North American President Jay Parker says servers represent a growing business unit. "We've doubled our server business last year," he said, adding that the server division was launched in North America in earnest about 3 years ago. "We've roughly doubled it every year." Recent success has been fueled, he says, by an already announced collaboration with EMC, a data storage company with a big triangle presence. Some of EMC's storage solutions have been fully integrated into the Lenovo portfolio, increasing the attractiveness of the technology, Parker notes. Could IBM's 86X server business take Lenovo to a higher level? Maybe. At the very least, reports of a potential purchase will give shares a needed boost, says G-Asia analyst Jean-Louis Lafende. Lenovo's share price has tanked of late, he notes, pointing to a fall from $9 to $6.5 in about a month. This kind of news leak may serve to keep the share price from tanking. But should Lenovo really make a play for IBM's x86 assets, it would be the biggest deal for Lenovo since the first time IBM asset buy years ago. Either way, Lenovo needs to move beyond pure PCs as it is shrinking. It is a shrinking market over the long term, and so far Lenovo's smartphone and tablet business is almost exclusively a domestic affair, he points out. That first deal did more than bring Lenovo to North Carolina, Parker points out. Parker joined the company 2 years after it acquired the PC assets. Lenovo only had a presence in China, he explains. It was completely a China-based company. So simply put, the acquisition of the IBM PC company opened up the rest of the world to Lenovo. Could a server asset buy do something similar? It's possible. Lafayette believes it's something the market would be receptive to if it's at the right price. IBM had no comment on what it regarded to be rumors, but has made recent moves that impacted the local headcount. Big Blue sold its retail business to Tokyo-based Toshiba Tech last year for $850 million, a move that impacted 330 RTP employees. And IDC numbers put IBM's x86 server business at being worth $35.8 billion last year and accounting for two-thirds of all server spending. Here's a sidebar to the previous article. Could PCs come back? Lenovo's Jay Parker, president of the Chinese computer maker's North American division, says PCs are coming back. "We actually believe the PC market, potentially starting in the second quarter of this year, will actually start to grow again." Why? He credits two primary reasons, the refresh cycle and Windows 8. We're up against a new refresh cycle in the commercial space, he explains. Corporations that have been holding on to their PCs to try to save capital expenditure budgets, it's time where they have to refresh them again. He says these refresh cycles typically happen once every 3 years, so we believe that over the next 12 months we're due for one again. Windows 8, introduced last year, could also help drive sales, he says, noting that the days of Windows XP are ending. But Lenovo is not sitting idly by and waiting, he notes, pointing to products that take advantage of the growing interest in tablets, such as the convertible Yoga. We would have to be crazy not to consider the trends that are going on out there in the marketplace, he says. Expect to see even more investments in the smartphones, he says, an area that grows even faster than the tablet. Next up, Spotlight Downtown Raleigh. Happy days are here again as building surges downtown. This article is by Amanda Jones Hoyle and is from Raleigh. Downtown Raleigh is prepping for a year-long topping-off party, as more than $400 million in both private and public building projects will either open or break ground this year. Not since 2008 has Raleigh's Central Business District had such momentum from new businesses and new residents moving into the downtown core. It feels like there's so much more activity, says Andrew Stewart, president of Raleigh's Empire Properties, which has one of the largest portfolios of downtown Raleigh property outside of the state government. On the residential side, the first of more than 450 apartment units under the construction at the St. Mary's Square and the 425 North Bolin apartment projects in the Glenwood South District are slated to begin opening to tenants in May. Corporate-wise, Red Hat expects to complete its relocation of 900 workers from NC State University's Centennial Campus to the Red Hat Tower by early summer. Citrix Systems wants to begin moving its 200 employees in Raleigh into a renovated building that's under construction in the Warehouse District before the end of the year. Ipreo, a New York data services company, announced in mid-April that it will bring 250 jobs to Raleigh, and many of them are expected to be located downtown. Finding space is becoming an issue, though, as 94.2% of downtown's Class A space is occupied. That has office developers from across the region scrambling to secure prime sites to meet the demand. Dominion Realty Partners of Raleigh announced in April that it would break ground in November on the 11-story Charter Square office building next to City Plaza on Fayetteville Street. The $54 million building would be the first big office building to open in downtown Raleigh since PNC Plaza opened in 2008. Dominion was involved in that project as well. A group of New York investors in December purchased the vacant 11-story former bank office building at 227 Fayetteville Street and has started an $8 million renovation that is expected to be finished in the fourth quarter. Also opening in 2013 will be the $187.7 million Wake County Justice Center, the $40 million State Employees Credit Union Tower near the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences, and the new $16 million North Carolina State Bar Headquarters Building. Stewart says Empire Properties plans to break ground in the fall on its long-awaited L Building project, which will add 83 apartment units and 11,000 square feet of retail space that will be wrapped around a county-owned parking deck at the corner of Davie and McDowell Streets. We are super close on the financing for starting construction of the L Building, Stewart says. We have three banks looking at it now and figuring out how it's going to work. Empire Properties in April purchased two single-story buildings in Raleigh's Warehouse District that flank the former Dr. Pepper bottling buildings at 416 South Dawson Street that Empire has owned since 2010. Stewart says the buildings altogether will open up 50,000 square feet of potential new office space for companies looking to move downtown. We are starting to see a decent amount of companies in the suburban markets who are now ready to move downtown, Stewart says. They've been hearing so much about what's happening down here, and they are ready now. This week's editor's notebook is from Sugata Mukherjee, and he is the editor of Triangle Business Journal. His column is titled, An Ominous Trend in the Workplace. After reading our front page story on how more and more North Carolinians are taking their employers to court, claiming they are not being paid justly, I am left wondering if that's a byproduct that helps explain why some corporations have become more productive in the recent past. You talk to any executive in town or across the nation, and they will say this, quote, "We have to do more with less in order to survive," end quote. These executives should know. They almost went out of business a couple of years back. In fact, thousands did. So why this disconnect between the employers and the employees? If we can't solve this issue, there is some hurt in store for companies and workers alike. I checked with the folks at New York-based NERA Economic Consulting, a firm that follows wage and hour settlements and trends in the workplace. They gave us an updated brief on what's going on in terms of settlements. As our stories this week point out, some of these numbers are simply astonishing. 1. Companies in 2012 paid $467 million to settle lawsuits alleging wage and hour complaints. 2. On average, companies paid $4.8 million to resolve large cases in 2012, up from $4.6 million in 2011. 3. In the majority of cases, the average value of the settlement per plaintiff was between $1,000 and $1,500. What is not surprising, however, is the type of businesses that are defendants in these lawsuits. Numbers show that more than a third of the wage and hour cases involved overtime issues and only 18% involved misclassification of employees. That makes the financial services, insurance, and retail industries most vulnerable to wage and hour claims. But there is one industry, per NERA, that requires special attention: healthcare and healthcare services. In 2012, the average settlement for cases in the healthcare services industry was nearly three times the average of any industry. A quick look at Wall Street in the past 18 months suggests many companies are steering the ship in the right direction. Revenue and profitability are up, and the companies are getting there with fewer employees. That, many suggest, explains the jobless recovery. And blame aside, all these lawsuits are not helping. This week's guest opinion column is by Mr. Andy Allen, and he is president and general counsel of the North Carolina Retail Merchant Association. His column is entitled, "Making the Case Why We Need Parity Relating to Online Tax Issues." Never before have there been more options for consumers in choosing how, when, and where they shop. We live in a global marketplace. If I want to buy a new pair of shoes, I have a multitude of choices where to shop. I can drive to my local mall or visit the specialty shoe store just around the corner from my house. I can go online and type in the search engine the exact type and size shoe I'm seeking, and we'll have shoe sellers around the world provide me pricing and pictures within seconds. For the retail industry, this global marketplace is the new reality. 5 years ago, online retail sales were $175 billion. By comparison, in 2012, U.S. e-commerce sales amounted to $289 billion, a 65% increase. According to eMarketer estimates, online retail revenue in the United States will reach $361.9 billion in 2016. Simultaneously, the number of U.S. digital shoppers is expected to grow from 137 million in 2010 to 175 million in 2016. With this ever-increasing technology that is putting the world in the hands of shoppers, the retail industry is spending a significant amount of time talking about the multi-channel experience, which simply means making products available to customers where they are: in-store, online, mobile phone, tablet, etc. Retailers of all sizes know they need to adapt to survive. But for too long, the elephant in the room has been the fact that online-only retailers have a price advantage. In some states, it can be as much as 10% because they are not required to collect and remit sales tax from their customers. Under U.S. Supreme Court decisions dating to 1967 and 1992, out-of-state retailers have been shielded from state sales tax collection due to concerns about impending interstate commerce. The Marketplace Fairness Act, S-743, is a standalone bill in the U.S. Senate that would allow states the authority to require sales tax to be collected and remitted on every sale regardless of where the sale occurred. S-743 gives states the power to require online-only retailers to collect the sales tax for the state due on sales made. On April 22nd, the Senate voted 74-20 to bring the legislation to the floor for debate. The retail industry is deeply appreciative of the bipartisan support for this bill has received from Senators Richard Burr and Kay Hagan. Opponents of the legislation argue that this legislation is being pushed by big retail and that small businesses and consumers have a lot to lose. In fact, one of the largest opponents to this legislation is eBay, who has gone as far as sending an email to 40 million eBay users, saying that they are fighting this to ensure healthy competition, value, and selection that benefit online consumers. What is being left out of eBay and other opponents' arguments is that all bricks and mortar, i.e. Main Street retailers, both large and small, are required to collect and remit sales tax. All consumers are required to remit the same tax for online shopping, called a use tax on your tax return, though few seldom do. Folks, this is not a new tax. This legislation is simply bringing tax laws into the 21st century and leveling the playing field for those businesses who have a physical presence in a state and those who do not but choose to sell across state lines. For state governments that collect sales tax, which is 45 out of 50. The move to online shopping across state lines has led to significant drops in tax-generated revenue. North Carolina lost an excess of $436.5 million in sales tax from internet purchases by North Carolina residents. These uncollected funds can be used to assist in tax reform and lowering everyone's taxes, Medicaid reform, or for public education. There are those who argue that sales tax is a bad idea, but until there is no sales tax in the state of North Carolina, the retail businesses in our state, who employ citizens in their communities, pay property taxes, fund Little League teams, and PTA fundraisers, deserve a fair shake when it comes to competing with online retailers. Another argument circulating is that requiring small businesses to collect and remit sales tax in numerous states will drive the cost of doing business so high that they will be forced to close their doors. No pun intended. This is simply not true. The technology has been in place for several years now that will calculate the sales tax at the point of sale for the consumer. And states who have gone through the streamlined sales tax process, North Carolina is one of these, have simplified the process for remitting sales tax to the state. By giving online sellers an automatic 5 to 10% head start, it's virtually impossible for a Main Street retailer to compete on price. Internet companies having a 6.75% sales tax advantage in North Carolina is like Duke starting out the UNC football game with a touchdown lead. Even if they have the lower price, the sales tax loophole often makes the online retailer the winner. Bricks and mortar retailers have seen the writing on the wall and are addressing their need to adapt and compete in a rapidly changing marketplace. Now it's time for online-only retailers to see the writing on the wall and realize it's time to play fair when it comes to sales tax. This week's column, 9 to 5, has the following. Baker Roofing Company of Raleigh has installed a 94,000-square-foot roofing system on the covered structures at the University of North Carolina at Charlotte's newly constructed football complex. Baker installed roofing on all 11 buildings within the complex using a variety of materials. The complex includes the 15,300-seat stadium, as well as a fieldhouse, plaza, press box, university box, and concessions. Baker also completed the waterproofing and concrete paver install on the field house. We are proud to be involved in this project, and we know that bringing a Division I football team to Charlotte will have a notable impact on the city, says George Garvin, Vice President and General Manager of Baker Roofing's Charlotte location. Los Angeles-based Altiz Innovation, which produces book digitization hardware, has selected SNA Cherokee of Cary as its public relations agency of record. SNA Cherokee will lead the communication strategy for the launch of Altiz's most recent product, ScanDoc, which allows users to take professional-grade scans from their smartphone. Altiz was launched in Bangkok, Thailand in 2005 and subsequently relocated to Los Angeles. Vitrie Incorporated, an importer of Italian handcrafted dinnerware, flatware, glassware, linens, decorative accessories, and garden urns, celebrated its 30th year in business by partnering with SunTrust Bank to build a home with Habitat for Humanity in Orange County. Susan Gravely, with her sister Frances and mother Lee, founded Vitrie in 1983 after a family trip to Italy, where they fell in love with colorful, hand-painted dinnerware from the Amalfi Coast. Vitrie now serves a customer base of more than 2,000 specialty stores in all 50 states, plus Canada, England, Mexico, the Caribbean, Europe, South America, Asia, and Australia. It represents approximately 30 manufacturers throughout Italy. A few tidbits from this week's Triangle Business Journal. Who's the coolest golfer? Well, he's the one with no socks. The Triangle Business Journal still has the bug that's been going around ever since spring has sprung. The golfing bug, that is. The improving weather and all these televised tournaments have given Triangle Business Journal the itch. Watching the throngs of people congregate around the pros at these tournaments as they hit shot after shot dead on target got TBJ wondering, who is the coolest golfer ever? Well, Golf Digest magazine has just released a list of who it deems to be the coolest golfers, past or present, to ever grace a green. The magazine's top five are Fred Couples, Steve Ballesteros, Walter Hagen, Arnold Palmer, and Mickey Wright. Triangle Business Journal actually got to witness Couples, a.k.a. the King of Cool, firsthand at Media Day at the SAS Championship in Cary a few years back. And let it be known, it did seem he had the largest crowd in the field. And one of his playing partners that day? Why, it was the SAS honcho, Mr. Jim Goodnight. The price is right. UNC's Katie Taylor? Come on down. Anyone who has ever watched the TV show The Price is Right know it pays to be a wild and wacky audience member. Just ask UNC Chapel Hill pharmacy student Katie Traylor, who made it to the stage and has $10,000 to show for her outlandish behavior. To get ready, she told the Daily Tar Heel, I went to the bathroom and I would run, screaming, high-fiving people just trying to get noticed. A producer came up to her and he asked me what I like to do, and I was dancing around saying I like painting and drinking. Just saying something crazy because it didn't matter if it made sense. You just got noticed. CPA firm is merging and the local office expands. Raleigh accounting firm Lunsford & Strickland is merging with Charlotte's Elliott Davis, which will expand L&S's office in the capital city, which now has 14 professionals. The merger is expected to take effect on July 1. We have served Triangle-based clients for years. Therefore, Raleigh is a strategic opportunity and prime location for us, says Elliott Davis, managing shareholder of whose name is Rick Davis. Lunsford & Strickland was founded in 1989. Partners John Lunsford, James Hain, and Joan Strickland will join the new firm. And Schauffer lauds G1 starting a raising of $200,000. Christy Schaefer, former chief at Inspire Pharmaceuticals, talked funding this week. Now with Hatras Venture Partners, Schaefer has good things to say about portfolio company G1 Therapeutics, which recently announced a $1 million debt financing round via a securities filing. In an email, Schaefer wrote, "Hatteras has been very pleased with the progress since our investment in September. The program has accelerated and benefited from having both grant funding and venture funding. And G1 has nabbed nearly $460,000 so far in the round." And finally, Raleigh native Sedaris. Did he really say that? Raleigh native David Sedaris is out with a new book called Let's Explore Diabetes with Owls. If the title sounds a bit odd, well, it's because it was written by Sedaris, an oddly wired satirist. Given that Sedaris grew up here and still has family here, brother Paul Sedaris runs a local flooring company, Triangle Business Journal plucked a few tidbits from an interview with Sedaris published at the online site of the Oregonian, the daily newspaper in Portland, Oregon. Sedaris and his partner Hugh, who is frequently mentioned in his books, are known for having a penchant for buying houses. He explains how that came about. "My parents were, well, my dad still has some property near NC State in Raleigh, North Carolina, but they started off being slumlords, landlords in the kind of places where the tenants move out in the middle of the night and take the refrigerator with them. That was a real education. I just always thought I wanted nothing to do with it. I didn't realize how, when I was a renter, how much you appreciated by your landlord if you were a good tenant." Sedaris is the author of 8 books that have sold more than 7 million copies and have been translated into 25 different languages. If you're looking for sales leads, the annual Triangle Business Journal Book of Lists is a treasure trove of decision makers' names, contact information, employee counts, revenue, and more for hundreds of Triangle companies. The Book of Lists is free with a paid subscription to the Triangle Business Journal, or copies can be purchased by contacting Gary Cantrell at 919-327-1013. We've run out of time for this week's edition of the Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Al Reynolds, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program will be available online at TriangleReadingService.org immediately after the broadcast. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. So long until next time.